But why are we here? In the Fellowship of the Ring, that's a question being asked, because the task for Frodo, the task ahead of him seems almost too much, too hard, too daunting. "I wish it need not have happened in my time," said Frodo. "So do I," said Gandalf. "And so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us. All we have to decide to do is what to do with the time that is given us." For many of you here this week, next generation leaders, perhaps you wish for a different theme, a time to lead in the Christian education system when funding perhaps wasn't under threat, when the secular wolves were not howling at the gates. Back in the good old days of the 80s, when you rock up to the state or federal government, they say, and you say, "I want to find a Christian school," and you're going, "Like this?" "No, no, you don't understand, I'm Christian, that's okay, and I believe all this stuff about it, shh." You know? Is that what it was like, older people in the room? You see, our time, our age, is a time of cultural change. Are you, especially those who are younger, particularly unlucky? Was there a golden age it would have been better to have belonged to? A gentler ride, perhaps? And Gandalf makes two observations, doesn't he? The times are not ours to decide. That's the first thing. The times are not ours to decide. And secondly, our decision to do something with what has been given to us. We have to do something with the time that's been given to us, the age that we are in. God is sovereign. God plans the times. God is Lord of the ages. God has us for these times. God calls us to decide what to do with the time given us. And then, at the end of the age, he will call us to account for what we have done with the times that have been given to us. That should sober us up, should it not? Well, this week I'm going to explore with you, as I said, three aspects of our times that are daunting, three very daunting aspects of them, but which God has placed us within and which we are called to do something with. And no doubt it is a daunting age, a daunting time, but I want to encourage you, the leaders and future leaders of young people who are actually marinated in these times, whether they're Christian or not. A non-Christian coming to your school is just as marinated in the times as a Christian coming to your school. I want to encourage you that the God of the ages has this age in his hands as well. So, as I say, three critical realities of our age: a secular age, a sexual age, and self-actualized age. So the first critical reality of our times, a secular age. Now, this painting here, I love this painting, this particular painting, El Greco, the Spanish painter, painted this. It's a fantastic painting. It looks very modern, does it not? Very modern kind of painting. If you haven't heard of El Greco, you might think he's sort of hanging out in Spain at the moment. This was painted in 1604. It's a very modern-looking piece of art. It's called The Vision of St. John. And it's taken from the book of Revelation, the opening of the fifth seal, where the martyrs are, it says, seen under the altar, and they're going, "How long, O Lord? How long before you come and vindicate us and give us justice for our martyrdom?" And they're told to wait for a little longer. So there you go, there's on the side you see the martyrs, and they're going to be given robes of white, and there's John. So John with his hands up. Well, what are they up to? They don't seem to be up to much, because this painting is actually only part of the actual painting. 5 feet of the painting has been ripped off. It now sits in the Museum of Modern Art in New York, but it was actually a fresco above an altar in Spain, a massive piece. And the top bit has been torn off, ripped off, and is no longer available to us. And there's St. John, sort of with his hands up, looking ecstatic in his face towards sort of nothing, reaching up for something. It's considered that the top of the painting was actually the picture of the Christ figure on the throne, ruling the world, looking down, Revelation, apocalyptic and all that. And there's John looking up ecstatically into the heavens, reaching for something. But here he is, reaching, looking for something transcendent, looking hopefully, but it's no longer there. It's been ripped off. I would say that is the singular challenge in our secular culture. You can describe secularism in so many different ways. But I think churches, Christian schools, and organizations face this aspect of secularism. That the transcendent, the bit at the top, the 5 feet with the Jesus figured it, the bit above has been ripped off. What Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor calls disenchantment. We live in a disenchanted world. This is all there is. Nothing comes in from outside. Nothing goes here up. It's ripped off. If you've seen the CBS series, it was a great series to start and ended badly, I think, Under the Dome. This invisible dome comes down over this town called Chester Mill. And nothing can come into the town, and nothing can go out of the town. They are hermetically sealed from every other person. You can't see the dome, but it's there. It stops everything coming in, it stops anything going out. If you're going to describe the tone of the modern secular world, it is like that. The world is in a hermetically sealed dome. Nothing comes in, nothing goes out. It's as if in our thinking, in the thinking of the average person out on those streets, a huge hand has ripped off the top 5 feet of the painting. We're operating as people committed to transcendence, committed to a God who intervenes, an enchanted world, a world in which God himself in Jesus has broken in. But the consensus out there is that there's nothing above. You can raise your hands as much as you want. I'm just assuming in this congregation there can be people who can raise their hands. But yet, there's nothing there. A friend of mine who's a psychiatrist, when he oscillates between a church meeting and a meeting in the university department, has to check himself occasionally in the psychiatric meetings because he is about to say at the end of them, let's just close in a word of prayer. They'd be cutting him off to, his own ward. It's just not even thought about. It doesn't come into the equation. It feels ripped off. And yet, it feels ripped off. Because there's a desire for something more lingering in our culture, is there not? Just like that painting, people are reaching up towards some form or feeling of transcendence that they cannot even describe, that they don't even know. Despite the modern confidence that we should have in this technologically advanced world, there's a sense of dis-ease. A sense of uncertainty, and my wife is a clinical psychologist and sees it all the time. There's a sense of, is that all, is this it? There's a sense of being ripped off. I tracked with a friend on Facebook recently, he friended us last year, and I haven't seen him for years, and he used to go to my old church when I was a kid, and he sort of drifted away from church and went through a series of relationships, and then I lost contact with him. Time was not kind to him. I look at Facebook, I see, didn't ask, but he's got 2 sons who he seems to love. I know his sister who he seems to catch up with, but the rest was no deep relationships, no spouse, Freo Dockers label on top of his Facebook, the odd picture of him just sitting quietly having a beer somewhere. And then last week his son writes on his Facebook status update, I'm just sorry to tell you of the untimely death of our beloved father at the age of 55. He committed suicide. But I could sort of see it even in the photographs, as he had gone from sort of tall and blonde to fairly large and overweight and looking older than his years. I wonder if he's thinking, is this all there is? So when I told my brother about it, he wasn't surprised. A sense of being ripped off. You see, our friends, family, and neighbours, the kids in our schools, may shrug their shoulders and admit, oh, there's nothing ultimate, nothing transcendent, but they don't feel that way. Their desires and their language betrays them. They're still searching for significance and meaning, only they don't know where that is to be found. Have you noticed that? Have you seen that? James Smith puts it like this in his book, How Not to Be Secular. You're a church planter or a Christian school leader who have left your Jerusalem on a mission to Babylon. You came with what you thought were all the answers to the unanswered questions that so-called secular people had. But it didn't take long for you to realise that the questions weren't just unanswered, they were unasked. And they weren't questions. That is, your secular neighbours aren't looking for answers, for some bit of information that is missing from their mental maps. To the contrary, they have completely different maps. You've realised that instead of nagging questions about God or the afterlife, your neighbours are oriented by all sorts of longings and projects and quests for significance. There doesn't seem to be anything missing from their lives, so you can't just come proclaiming the good news of a Jesus who fills their God-shaped hole. They don't have any sense that the secular lives they've constructed are missing a second floor. In many ways, they have constructed webs of meaning that provide almost all the significance they need in their lives. Though a lot of hinges, he says, on that word, almost. That is a huge challenge, isn't it? As Christians, educators, Christian educators in the 21st century. Nothing missing from their lives. No sense, he says, that the secular lives they've constructed are missing a second floor or 5 feet of fresco. They're living on ground floor and they just assume that's all there is. Now, maybe because they've lived through a Christian framework and we're in a post-Christian setting, they're in this house where there's a place where a staircase once was to that second floor, but it's hard to access, it's boarded up, it's badly renovated, so they can see that something was there, but they're not really that interested in what it was. The detritus of Christianity is still around the place, as C.S. Lewis says. That we're now, he said this 50 years, so he said it just after the war in the UK, that in this era, after the Christian wave in the West, the ground has now grown up with trees and bushes again. But it's not virgin territory. If you search through it, you'll see it's a broken glass, toys, a brick, from where the houses were raised, and the suburbs being covered by the trees again. A little like Detroit. The edges of the city of Detroit has just been taken over by nature again. The signs are there that something existed, but no one can put it together. No one knows what it was like. That is most people in the post-Christian world. They have an idea about this, or as Ken said, I like to keep the... Well, I don't even think people do say that these days. I want to keep, the Sermon on the Mount. People don't even know what it is, the young people, especially. So the new atheists have been saying for years, we've painted over and nailed down all the other hundreds of gods. Let's just get rid of the final few. Especially the Christian God, and we'll be done. At the 2016 census, the number of Christians dropped some 10% since the 2011 census, primarily because of this reason, not because people suddenly became really hard, but because they had a no religion option to tick. And that is set to increase as the early baby boomers age and die, and the young people in this room rise to take over and sort it all out. The idea of the religious, the transcendent, as a place to look for ultimate meaning is disappearing in the modern world. But there's a glitch in the modern, a pressure point that provides opportunity. Listen to what Jamie Smith said again. Your neighbours are oriented by all sorts of longings and projects and quests for significance. They have constructed webs of meaning that provide almost all of the significance they need in their lives. Do you see the glitch? That word, almost. Almost all of the significance they need in their lives. Not all. Almost all. Here's the glitch. If humans were factory fitted by God to worship Him, then a lesser task, a lesser goal, will leave them with that ripped off sense, even if they cannot fully articulate it. They were created to worship. We were created to worship, and we will worship. See, here is what is not happening by and large. Faced with this sense of being ripped off, the loss of the transcendence, the lack of a second floor or a second story, The modern Westerner is not throwing up his or her hands and saying, oh well, there's nothing transcendent, there's no ultimate project, let's get on with less meaningful, second-rate lives. Anyone? Anyone? Not at all. To the contrary, they're investing deep levels of transcendency into non-transcendent goals. Deep levels of ultimacy into non-ultimate projects. That is why so many are ending up at the clinical psychologist. If the average Westerner was much more cold-eyed about the fact that there is nothing transcendent, they wouldn't be rocking up saying, why? Why is this not working out for me? Because then you'd have to ask, what's not working out for you? What is supposed to work out for you? Faced with the loss of the gospel, people had to, must, create other forms of good news. Western culture has not given up on meaning and significance. It has simply moved it one floor down. If there is no transcendent second floor, then the first floor will have to bear the weight of transcendence and ultimacy. And guess what? The foundations weren't built to do that. They weren't built to do that, but try it we will. But you know that, don't you? Because when you're driving past the Mazda CX-3 ad on the bus shelter, and it says, be moved like never before. Be moved like never before. I just kept driving past that and went, I don't really feel all that moved, you know. But I went and Googled it, and I found the ad campaign and the sort of the brief for that ad campaign. It also has a TV campaign as well. The car's there, there's a dancer, the car's sort of on a plinth, and there's this creative form dancing around it. This film for Mazda's new CX-3, says the brief, sets out to represent Mazda's design mantra, the soul of motion. Inspired by this ideology, the narrative was approached as a motion sculpture, a striking work of art shaped by the most powerful and graceful expression of human movement, dance. Careful choreography and bespoke VFX techniques combine as a potent and iconic signature of movement. The highly architectural setting, the altar upon which the car was placed, was carefully designed to hero the presence of the car and provide a focus for the dance performance. I feel moved like never before, because that is transcendence right there, isn't it? The mantra, it says, the ideology, hero the presence of the car. I mean, what do you want? Stained glass with, you know, Mazda CX-3 and, you know, in a church setting? There'll always be a place for a Kingswood, though, for that stained glass. But the car itself is sitting, without any sense of irony, it's sitting on a thing called the altar. Don't ask, how do we evangelize the kids in our schools? They are being evangelized 24/7. That is what is so perplexing. We're a network of churches in Perth at Providence Church, and Rory Shiner, our senior pastor, noted that we've got all our congregations are in the afternoon, and a lot of people, you get the problem of second service people, people who come along in the evening from, you know, for the show, but they're going somewhere else in the morning, wherever. I'm not bitter about it. And he said, lots of second service people, but then he said, actually, everyone who comes to church is a second service person because they have been going through a discipleship and formation program Monday to Saturday that is knocking it out of the park. That's what's so difficult, isn't it? Our task is to evangelize second service people with a better, bigger, grander gospel. To truly move them like never before, not by a car, but by a creator, by a savior, rather than settle for the worst sin in the Bible, which is to worship and serve the created thing, not the creator, as Romans 1 tells us. We are being evangelized 24/7 by non-transcendent and non-ultimate projects with a good news story of providing transcendence and ultimacy. First four floor projects pretending to be second floor. Humans need that second floor. So what do they do? What do? We push our first floor projects upwards. Now, in the modern West, what is the most popular project, first floor project, to push up to the second floor? Me. Project me. We are our transcendent project. We are our own quest for significance. That is the way it is pitched to us. Which brings me to the second picture, which you sneakily say. Bruce Jenner had a classic project from the first floor pushed to the second floor. He's the cultural hero of the transcendent project. In 1976, Bruce Jenner was the Olympic decathlon champion, the face that launched 1,000 cereal boxes after the Olympics. He was the pinnacle of manhood. He said that when he won, he just felt so masculine about life. 1976. But throughout that time, before it, during it, and after it, he was struggling with gender dysphoria. And the glitch for Bruce Jenner is that Olympic gold, as a man, I'd settle for a bronze medal, right? Yeah? Anyone? I even place the final. It wasn't transcendent enough. It didn't do it. Boris Becker said the same thing when he won Wimbledon at the age of 17. He stood on the balcony of his hotel, tempted to jump off. And now, 50-something, in huge debt, with several relationships failed, on the front pages all the time, looking a bit sad and bloated himself, it seems that that was the pinnacle. You peaked early. It's a long way down from there. The glitch for Bruce is that Olympic gold wasn't transcendent enough. It was a first floor project pushed upstairs, and it didn't make it the whole way. I think that's our problem, because what do? We scurry around looking for one that we think will get there. If we fail at one, if we only get it halfway up and it's stuck on the landing, we abandon it and we find something else. Puritan pastor Thomas Chalmers has a great sermon called The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. And he bases this on Calvin's idea that the human heart is an idol factory. A little production line, just coming along this little production line. We produce them. And Thomas Chalmers, in The Expulsive Power of a New Affection, says that a man, there was a man in his sermon, you know, as a boy, he's affected and loves his toys and games. But those affections are expelled, removed, pushed aside as he grows older. Then it goes to pleasure and fun. And that then in turn, as he mans up, is expelled by this desire for power and influence. And that then is expelled by his politics and gravitas. And so he goes through his life. But at no point is there a place where his heart does not have some affection at its center, sitting on the throne. Because that is how we're built. We are built for that. And Chalmers says it's only when Christ comes in and expels all those other affections and stays there that you stop that merry-go-round, that idol factory, from running the whole way to the end of your life. But our culture has moved even beyond placing something external as the idol. Because that's not transcendent enough for us. We have the technology to take transcendence to a whole new level. We have the technology to move ourselves to the second floor just through who we are or who we can be. Which is why you get Caitlyn Jenner, 40 years between the two events. A generation. Within one generation, gender can be the pinnacle of manhood and the pinnacle of womanhood. The same person. This is the age you live in. Would you have thought that? Caitlyn Jenner, Bruce Jenner, transitioned. The culture did not see this as gender dysphoria, something that we needed to help Bruce with, but as something to celebrate and for Bruce to self-actualize with. The modern age has given us the technology and the emotional mindset to hold out a hope of transcendence like that at an even deeper level. The front page of Vanity Fair. It seems a bit greedy, doesn't it? In the same lifetime, to be the pinnacle of manhood and womanhood at the same time. That's a whole lot of transcendence right there for one person. And gender is an icon for the self as transcendent project, the search for ultimacy, the ability to break your limits. The promise of our culture is that we can ascend to not only that second floor, but the sky is the limit. It's the glass elevator. Charlie and Chocolate Factory fan. The sky is the limit in the secular age, even while we deny that there is anything outside the dome. That's the great irony. You know what this does? And this is where we have to really mine into this, and you have to mine into it as you go into this culture of the next 10, 15, 20 years, working with young people. This explains why there's such heat towards the gospel from what I call the secular culture, which we'll deal with tomorrow. Because it's not simply different ideas or a battle to fill a God-shaped hole. It's a transcendency war. This is an ultimate battle. When the German soldiers were fighting the Russians, and the Russians were in Stalingrad, it was the fiercest fighting of the war. Because for the Russians, there was nowhere to step back after Stalingrad. Lose Stalingrad, you lose everything. They fought to the death. That was all there was. This is all there is, they said. I think that is why it made no sense in the same-sex marriage debate last year. The Christians were saying to people, we don't have to agree with what you do to love you. While that may be true, that was not what was being heard. There's a reason for that, because as Christians who have an understanding of what transcendent is outside of ourselves, we were landing on the wrong floor. We were assuming ground floor categories with people. This is not an ultimate thing. Sex is only a pointer to something different, something bigger, something more transcendent. We were assuming people understood that we viewed them as having values at a second floor level. When all along they assumed they were already on the second floor. That the way they were living their lives was that transcendent thing that was left. And we're saying, no. There's transcendence above that. And they're going, forget it. This is it. We were therefore denying them the significance and meaning that is up there. You can say all you like. I affirm you, I love you, but I don't agree with you. And that is never gonna make it because of that first floor, second floor difference. The people in a wider culture thinking second floor, it was simply this. Our gospel, our good news, was not good news to them. It was bad news. Very bad news indeed. And political and legal power is working hard with cultural power, think Qantas, think the Australian Rugby Union, to embed that gospel in our national psyche. We are marinating in it. That is why it is so hard to engage with it at even a conversational level. That is why 30-year-olds who are Christians quietly just self-censor about these topics on social media, because they will get roasted. That's the perplexity facing gospel communities, be they churches or schools. It's difficult. That's why we see funding threatened so quickly. That's why what we view as good news can be seen as a veiled expression of hate speech. Those are the complexities that we're dealing with as we live in this world. Philosopher Charles Taylor says that for the first time in human history, anywhere here in the West, the goal of human flourishing is human flourishing. The goal of human flourishing is human flourishing. Never before in time, never anywhere else, even now outside the Western world, has human flourishing been the end game. The goal of human flourishing is the glory of God. But if you take that bit out, the goal of human flourishing becomes God. And people will fight for their gods for a long time, fiercely. But with the challenge, there's opportunity. With the perplexity comes a gospel message that betrays the lack of true character and resilience within the ripped-off culture. You see, despite the Me Project and all of the promises of transcendence, the cracks are starting to show. And we're going to speak more about this tomorrow. People are wondering why this supposed second floor isn't giving them the view they paid for. If you think about the sexual revolution that kicked off in 1963, we've had 54, 55 years of it. Long enough to test some of the theories. Is this working out? But in the age of the permanent revolution, we're always told it's just one step ahead. It's just a little bit further down the line. That's why in the same-sex marriage debate, when Christians were saying, well, you know, it's not going to end there, and people were saying, well, we'll rule a line under that, and it'll all, you know, that'll stop things. No, that was the first page in the story. It's the permanent revolution. In his book, Sex and the I-Will, Dale Kuhn observes this. Despite the promises, the culture is not delivering. Two of the primary difficulties facing people in our culture are loneliness and insecurity. I'll read that again. Despite the promises, the culture is not delivering. Two of the primary difficulties facing people in our culture are loneliness and insecurity. You'd have to say that's true. It isn't delivering. Which brings me to a fourth picture. There's another hand reaching up. The Truman Show, great movie, has its flaws, but it's a fantastic movie. Originally intended to be a narrative against a religious perspective on the world, that you can break out from what this sort of stultifying God has created, in this dome of which Truman is living, where his whole life is a film set, where everyone he relates to is in a transactional relationship with him that he doesn't even know. And he has all these memories of things. And he meets that girl and they drag her away and they kick her off the movie set. Everyone's an actor. Wow, it was a documentary, wasn't it? But you know the movie premise, that he longs for something more, something transcendent. The thing he feels most in his life is ripped off. He has everything. He can have everything. But he feels ripped off. So he gets in that boat, and despite the best efforts of Christos, the director, who's overseeing it, he gets across the water to find that place beyond where he lives. And then he bumps into a wall. The boat goes, dunk. And when he gets out and he looks at it, you kind of know, he goes, I knew it. And then he puts his hand out to touch it. And what does he do? He gasps. There's something outside. There's more reality than I've been told. I've been ripped off. There's something truly transcendent, despite the colourful lure of what is imminent. The world that says this is all there is. There's something outside the dome. Now our culture, secular as it is, would feel ripped off if he got back in that boat and sailed back home, wouldn't it? There's a door that he has to walk through. And if the film ended like our culture tells us the world is, we'd feel ripped off. But our storytellers are telling us, no, there is something more. People would want their money back if there wasn't. So how does that look for me as a church pastor and for you as leaders and up-and-coming leaders in schools? Well, that hand touching that wall should give you confidence that given time, a cultural tsunami will start to deposit the bodies on the shore. As we look at tomorrow, it's doing that already. The people who tried it all, pushed as far as they could, swiped left or right as often as they could on Tinder, have done as much me project as they could afford, and Bruce Jenner could afford to do a lot of me project, and it's still not enough. No wonder people are starting to feel ripped off by the cultural promises that are over-promising and under-delivering. People are still looking for something transcendent, something beyond the dome, something ultimate and enchanted, and their hearts are restless till they find their rest in Him. Of course, this has to actually look like something on the ground, doesn't it? When I was speaking with CN last time, I told a story about a running mate, Steve, who was intrigued by the gospel. They'd started coming along to church, and he sort of dipped in and out of it a bit, and sort of dipped away from it at the moment, and I feel frustrated by that. Here's a guy who's looking for something. He's freshly divorced, got two late teen kids, running a lot more than I am, because he's running for something, he's looking for something. People who run, generally, are trying to change something about their lives. I have a friend who plants a church and runs our run club, and he said, the problem with running is it's too good. We should have gone into something else because people are looking for something, start running, and often find the endorphin kick is so good they think that's what it is. It's close. So I feel for Steve that he's pulled away from the gospel. I feel, you know, every time you get someone come along who's sort of new and they're not Christian, they're going out the door and you're sort of holding onto their leg, you know? But God is sovereign. Let me give you another story. Our church. We have a young intern, he's also a runner, so you have to be a runner to be an intern in our church. A girl called Maddie. And Maddie is a product of a very strong atheist family background, living in the hills of Perth. Deep green would be what I would describe her family as. And out of the blue, 7 or 8 years ago, she became a Christian at Perth College, which is one of the well-heeled inner city suburbs. Schools in one of the suburbs of Perth. Very expensive school to go to. So she's working on our staff. She went to Perth College 7 years ago. She's trained to be a speech therapist, so she's working between jobs. And she gets this phone call 2 weeks ago from a girl called Kylie, who says, "Hey, do you remember me?" She says, "Yeah." She says, "We went to school together 7 years ago." "Yeah." They weren't particularly close. They were friendly, but not close. She said, "I remember you were a Christian at school." "Yeah." He said, "I watched your life. And I watched when you become a Christian and some of the girls were having really hard conversations with you about it. You can imagine those schools can be pretty tough environments. And I was really impressed. He said, can I talk to you?" So they meet up and have coffee. It turns out that Carly, who's now got a good job at Curtin University, having had a good school experience and having a very loving, but very strongly atheist family also, like Maddie's family, somehow felt that something was missing. And out of the blue, she found a piece of text that she Googled because she thought it was amazing. And it was from the book of Numbers. "You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk." And she said, that seems right. And something happened. Now, you hear stories of Muslims in deep Muslim countries getting dreams about Jesus. She said, that's amazing. And then she started reading. And then she started reading the Bible. Then she phones Maddie. And she says, I need to meet with you and talk to you. And her family are going, yeah, it's just a hobby. You'll get over it. And then she came to church. And then she came to some of the other things we've done. And then I was talking to her about it. And she says, oh, there's all these connections and patterns in the Bible. It just, like King was saying, the greater Moses in Jesus. Just explaining that to her, she didn't get bored. She got excited. And I said, well, you know, when God saves a person, and she said, can you stop? What word did you just say? I said, saves. She said, I think God saved me a few weeks ago. I said, but you weren't coming to our funky hipster church to be impressed by it. How could you get saved? You know? You see the point? Now, we crank the handle really hard, don't we? And we go to Christian Kmart and there's 100 books on how you should do church if non-Christians are ever going to believe. We're just not that good. We're just not that splendid. We're just not that glorious. God is. Because God reaches down through the impervious dome and touches Carly's life with no one around, with a gospel seed that was planted by a young new Christian 7 years ago at a posh school in the inner suburbs of Perth. And 7 years later, it sprouts. We're told by Jesus that the kingdom of God is like a farmer who plants the seed, then he works really hard. No, he sleeps. And it grows. And he doesn't know how. That's the Spirit of God bringing life to the dead. The transcendent God breaking in. And here we were thinking our funky hipster missional churches were going to do that for young people today. And all along, it was God. See, Carly had almost all the meaning and significance that she needed in her life. Almost. But she felt ripped off. She felt that there must be something more than the first floor arrangement. No matter the furniture and the soft furnishings that she bought. We didn't transform her. We didn't point out, here's the second story. God did it through his word, through the book of Numbers. What an encouragement, isn't it? As we're shaped by and as we shape Christian educational communities in these secular times. Students are coming to your schools from families who are doing not just me project, but family project, aiming for something better. Everyone is the island of Ibiza, as it says in About a Boy. Every family is a little Ibiza, a little Bali, trying to have the most pleasant experiences it can, trying to self-actualize itself, aiming for something that gives their kids more than they had, perhaps. That gives you the opportunity to point to that second floor, doesn't it? More than that, it gives you the opportunity to live together as a school community in such a way that life only makes sense if there is a second floor, something beyond the dome. How do you do forgiveness as a staff when you get something wrong with each other? How do you say sorry to a student? We forgive as God in Christ has forgiven us, but if God in Christ has not forgiven us, you have to be self-righteous. There is no other option. How do you deal with telling kids what the future goals need to be? What they should be? What the future looks like? And even as we do those things haltingly or naively, like young Maddie did 7 years ago to the young Carly, people are soaking it in. 7 years after high school, after that degree that they get, they could sit down and say, is this all there is? The secular times will continue to be secular. Even more so, I'm thinking, the next 15 to 20 years. But our confidence is built in knowing that the Christian gospel, the message about Jesus, Jesus himself, provides meaning, significance, and ultimacy beyond what the world is able to offer. I often say this as a board member of Christian school systems, I believe that Christian schools are on the front line, because they're often the first and only place that many young people find out that they have been ripped off, that there is a top 5 feet of the painting that they haven't heard about, that there is something towards which they can stretch their hands and their longings that will not satisfy anywhere else. And it will do it not simply at school or university, but into eternity. Our confidence is built upon that conviction. Whatever happens to our funding in secular times, whatever happens to anti-discrimination legislation, a ripped off world will one day discover just how ripped off it has been. And then if it raises its hands for something more, what will it discover? A transcendent king who broke through the dome and came down to us in the person of the Lord Jesus, who went to the cross so that no one should ever feel ripped off again. Amen.